Today, Morris Wax will be presenting a program on our inner ape, evolution of human empathy, and I look forward to it. Today, the opening words will be spoken by Morris.
The opening words are a poem written in 1899, or written, I don't know if they were written in 1899, by a poet who was a former prime minister in Canada, Frank Scott. It's called Villanelle for Our Time. From bitter searching of the heart, quickened with passion and with pain, we rise to play a greater part. This is the faith from which we start. Men shall know commonwealth again from bitter searching of the heart. We loved the easy and the smart, but now, with keener hand and brain, we rise to play a greater part. The lesser loyalties depart, and neither race nor creed remain from bitter searching of the heart. Not steering by the venal chart that tricked the mass for private gain, we rise to play a greater part. Reshaping narrow law and art, whose symbols are the millions slain from bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part.
And for people who believe it's in the order of service, this is just a busio. The creative chaos, we're going to have this story for all ages today after all. Will the children please come up, and Matt Morris will read a story for you.
Oh, hi, guys and gals.
You should have done that. Thank you.
Any of you know where Washington, what do you know about Washington, D.C.? That's a good thing to know, yeah. Well, I grew up there 76 years ago. Can you believe that? It's amazing. I grew up in a house that was a row house. You probably don't have any clue what that is, but anyhow. And it also had an alley behind it. All of this is actually irrelevant to what I'm going to say, but that's all right. Doing it extemporaneously. And you have a great smile. With good teeth, nice lined up there. Well, I lived in a house, and my father had a shop on the first couple of floors, and then in the basement was really neat. It was all, there was really unfinished, was all kinds of junk down there. But one of the neat things about in that basement, well, there was a little stove, and I used to go down there to be by myself and put things in the fire and watch them, the pages of the magazines turn. But there were also rats down in the basement. And these are not there are other rats in Washington too, but they're mostly two-legged. These are four-legged rats, but they're not these little cute white rats. They're actually really dark and long and sort of kind of ugly. Anyhow, I really liked the rats. And they were kind of neat. So I would sit and watch them, and they had a little area which I sort of called their room. I never told my parents this because they could have got, you know, freaked out about it. I'm down there playing with the rats when I should be doing something useful. Anyhow, one day, one of these rats, I had one of these rats I called Joe. He was my favorite rat. He was a little sleeker, a little nicer looking than the others, given if you're a rat, you could appreciate that. Anyhow, one day a hole magically appeared in the wall of Joe's room, and he was curious. You probably know of Curious George, but this was Curious Joe. He poked his head through this hole and went in, and the hole disappeared. But then he heard this squeaking sound. Squeak, 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 squeak. He looked all around. He couldn't figure out what was going on, but he looked up. And to his great surprise, he saw this other rat, he called him Jim, hanging in a harness and struggling and squealing. And so Joe walked around the room wondering, looking up, wondering, what in the world is going on here? And finally, he came across this little pedal on the ground, and he stepped on it just hoping something would happen. And Jim came lower down into the ground. And he went over and just sort of chatting with Jim. Now, why do you think he was so excited about seeing Jim getting lowered to the ground. What do you think? He cared about Joe, even though he didn't know Joe. And you can imagine that happening. I'm sure you've met strangers, kids that you don't know, and they were having hurt their knee or something and fell down, and you were concerned about that, right? I see you are. Yeah. You say, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you. So that's what I'm talking about today, how you can have empathy, how you can feel some other person's pain when they are hurt and help them. So enjoy whatever you're doing afterwards. I have no clue, but it's probably some sort of a class, I guess, you're going to, right? Or you're going to sit here and listen to the entire... But now I've got to get up.
Thank you so much, Morris. Thank you. I think we're all worn out, worrying about why there's always war on this earth. And back when I first came of age in the Vietnam War, when the first war, or the carnage involved, was on national television every night, we had different takes on the issue. We had Desmond Morris, who wrote The Naked Ape and pinned it all on the aggressive chimp in all of us. On the other end, we had the naked John Lennon and Yoko Ono in bed singing, "All We Have to Do Is Give Peace a Chance." Since then, we've had a lot more sophistication in trying to figure out exactly what is the plumbing, what is the internal scaffolding in that 3 pounds of pulsating jelly that we call our brain, to figure out why we do these terrible things from time to time. At the same time, we have these wonderful things that come from the human soul. And it's always been fascinating for me to figure out how people who have studied this issue to help and share with us what we've learned. In the last decade, it's been an enormous amount of discovery. And so this week we have Morris Waxler talking, and then we have a real power couple in Madison. In 2 weeks we have his wife, Carolyn, both brain experts at the university, retired. And I think it's no coincidence that 1 month after we announced this series, the president announces the brain mapping initiative in Washington. But anyway, it's going to be a great pleasure to introduce Morris. He's a member of the first UU in Madison and also the UU Fellowship in Door County, where he and his wife Carolyn share his times. He has a PhD in psychology, brain and behavior, and an enduring interest in evolution and religion. And today his reflections are based in part on the singing Neanderthals and our inner ape, the bonobos. Morris?
It's a pleasure to be here. I've never been here before, and it's wonderful. Wonderful. In classical times, Greek and Hebrew culture, women, slaves, and animals were lined up in descending order of inferiority under the dominant male. Consistent with this debasing ethic, later Europeans considered Africans to be savages, apes. For hundreds of years, Europe was awash with human blood from wars, crusades, homicides, genocides, torture, and an infanticide. Hobbes exclaimed life as short and brutish. Christianity fostered beliefs of man's dominion over all of other animals. We are made of special stuffs that beasts do not possess, so was said. Use them, abuse them. Never mind, they don't feel or think. The philosopher Herbert Spencer coined the phrase survival of the fittest after Charles Darwin demonstrated evolution of species by natural selection. Survival of the fittest became the rallying cry for unrestrained capitalists who rationalize the grim life of ordinary people and relieve themselves of any responsibility for human pain and suffering. How convenient. Later evolutionary theorists interpreted fitness in terms of reproductive fitness. In The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins typecast all living things as selfish. arising out of this form of fitness where one's survival is at the expense of others. He misleads us. The story is much more nuanced and complex. The evolution of mammals, primates, and humans is also survival of the kindest. Here is the tale not told by Dawkins. It brings us back to the keen observations of Charles Darwin that speak also to the multifaceted nature of all creatures. In The Descent of Man, he said, "The difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is certainly one of degree and not of kind. The senses and intuitions, the various emotions and faculties that man claims may be found in an incipient or even sometimes in a well-developed condition in the lower animals. Empathy is one of these emotions." Darwin went on to say, "Besides love and sympathy, animals exhibit other qualities connected with the social instincts, which in us would be called moral." The stories of rats, Joe and Jim, is true. However, it took place in a laboratory, not in my basement. Other experiments have shown that monkeys refuse to eat if an unfamiliar monkey is given an electric shock at feeding time. In addition to experiments, there are many observations of empathy in other creatures. We hear about them in the news. A chimpanzee who saves an injured bird. Shields a young boy who had fallen into a cage. Sometimes these rescues are costly, as was the case for an adult chimpanzee who drowned trying to save an infant chimp who fell into the moat. Chimpanzees cannot swim and are deeply afraid of water. Empathy is an emotional response to another's distress. It consists of tender feelings on behalf of the other. It is often accompanied by efforts to understand the other's plight. It is also a motive force for action intended to reduce the other's suffering or relieve the other's hardship. For example, providing comfort, help, rescue, and protection. Empathy is at the core of several Unitarian Universalist principles, including respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Empathy is a major force in evolution, weaving humans into the web of life. We are social because our ancestral animals, too, were gregarious. Birds, monkeys, apes, and prehistoric hominids have become our social brains. They are in our heads, chirping, hooting, dancing, and singing with the joy of caring for others. Emotional experiences reside in particular brain fibers, triggering emotional expression when stimulated. This neural circuitry contains the evolutionary history of mammalian social behavior. Some emotions are fixed and limited to specific needs related to survival and reproduction. However, empathy casts a wider net than needs of the flesh or any one particular need. Moreover, it extends beyond the self to include the needs of others. Birds and mammals both strive and survive in societies. They form social bonds and show concern for others, newborn, kin, and strangers. Care for offspring has profound implications for group survival. For example, maternal separation causes rat pups to have disturbed sleep and to grow slower than pups raised by their mothers. Maternal separation of infant monkeys stresses them and releases hormones that lead to compromised relationships later in life. Scientific observations show that infant monkeys reared in total isolation remain unresponsive to the facial expressions of emotion by other monkeys. In Harlow's groundbreaking studies, baby monkeys preferred the comfort of a surrogate mother made of terra cloth rather than one made of wire. Tender maternal feelings is thus essential to empathy. Empathy evolved from what Paul MacLean termed a family way of life in mammals who nurture and protect their young. Ravens care for unfamiliar ravens. Rats will share highly preferred foods, chocolate, believe that or not, even with unfamiliar rats. Monkeys will refrain from retrieving food, even starving themselves, when it causes another monkey to receive a shock. Monkeys sometimes treat handicapped monkeys with more tolerance than they treat non-handicapped monkeys. Evidence abounds for empathy within most mammals, and sometimes is seen across species as well. Over the course of evolution, apes and prehistoric hominids encountered landscape changes challenging the existence of their small groups. Cooperation was essential. Kindness kept the tribes alive, weaving earlier fibers of empathy into a fabric of new brain, the neocortex. According to Franz de Waal, we are descendants of two species of chimpanzees, one patriarchic and one female dominant. The latter, called bonobos, make love, not war. And really, you have to see a video to believe this. Whereas the former, that's a form of greeting, hi, you know. Whereas the former are more aggressive. However, both show concern for species members, touch each other tenderly, exhibit pain and sorrow for one another, cheer underdogs, that's an interesting thing, primate cheering underdogs, anyhow, console and repair relationships, mediate conflict, and share food. Both chimpanzees and bonobos are our inner apes. Species of the earliest prehistoric hominids cared for one another in order to survive on the savanna. They split from apes 6 million years ago. They ran on all fours, but sometimes stood upright and walked the forest edge. Their numbers were small, physique puny compared to prey, and retreated to the trees for safety. As savannas spread, they spent more time upright as they adapted to the terrain. They remained partially upright for about 3 million years, with brains only slightly larger than those of apes. They evolved a larger brain, thinner skull, smaller jaw muscles, and became faster afoot. Hips and pelvises evolved to accommodate an upright posture, with babies born more dependent on mother and tribe than apes. They were small groups of 15 to 30 individuals who depended on each other to survive. They survived on the open savanna by cooperation, communication, and care. They vocalized to signal each other and to provide care and comfort at a distance. They scavenged large dead animals to obtain enough protein for their growing brains. They made nets to trap small game and stone tools to cut meat from carcasses. They built fires and hearths for protection, comfort, and cooking. They were already highly intimate groups, survivor of the kindest, when their population crashed about 2.5 million years ago. About 2 million years ago, the human population rebounded, increasing exponentially, and migrated out of Africa. They became fully upright, brain size doubled, and tool use became sophisticated. The increase in brain capacity relative to body size may have allowed us to show more complex forms of empathy, but the fundamental quality of feeling concern for others is part of our primate moral instinct. The feeling does not change. Stephen Mithin, in The Singing Neanderthals, analyzed the evolution of language. Walking and running upright required rhythmic coordination of muscle movement, giving the capability to express emotion in dance. Vocal grooming and signaling developed into a holistic, cagey, full-bodied miming and musical language, a chant-like language of commands, threats, greetings, and requests for care and comfort, probably sounding more like music than speech. It is perhaps no coincidence that musical language and empathy share common neural pathways, as seen in brain imaging studies in humans. Early human tribes were socially intimate communities, small, with shared experiences and knowledge of the environment. Their infants and toddlers needed very close care since the parents were hairless and infants could no longer cling to the mother. Mothers made slings to carry infants, for they moved frequently. Food sharing enhanced social bonding. Early humans showed empathic care for the disabled. For example, Neanderthals, 45,000 years ago, cared for a 50-year-old person with multiple injuries for many years. Neolithic humans cared for the disabled. For example, a teenage boy with dwarfism and extremely short arms, a 15-year-old boy with spina bifida, and a teenager who became paralyzed from the waist down 10 years earlier. They also cared for the dead. The first undisputed evidence of intentional burial was 130,000 years ago. The oldest known ritual burial is of a mother and child stained with red ochre about 100,000 years ago. And more elaborate ritual burials began about 40,000 years ago. Thus, human neocortex grew and culture emerged. Music, language, art. Our ancestors' expression of empathy enabled us to care for each other in rich and exciting ways. Now we can introspect and meditate on feelings evoked by a friend or lover. Our brains contain a history of empathy ingrained in us by countless social intimacies in birds, mammals, and prehistoric hominids. Animals survive in societies, so do we. They care for strangers, so do we. Our inner apes are kind. Empathy is integral to human nature. Keep weaving it. Make empathy the warp and weft of our lives. As the Dalai Lama says, compassion is the radicalism of our times. Or as I would say, we arose to play a greater part with kinder brain and tact, reshaping tribal smarts to serve the human heart. Quickened with passion and facts, this is the faith from which we start. When our breed, when breed nor creed no more remain to stoke our lesser loyalties, nor steer the shady strain and trick the mass for private gain. So we have come full circle. In a final quote from Darwin, as man advances in civilization, as smaller tribes are united into larger communities, individuals need to extend social instincts and sympathies to all members of the same nation, though personally unknown to them. This point being once reached, there is only an artificial barrier that prevents these sympathies from being shown to all others of all nations and races. Empathy is our core. Show affection for one another, take another's perspective, and act to alleviate another's distress. Create housing for the homeless, give hope to the helpless, and provide health care for all in need, including mental health care. Instead of imprisoning thousands of men and women, treat them for addictions and mental health problems. Treat and train them. Help make them productive members of society so we all benefit. We have the nerves to do it. Blessed be our inner apes. Well, there is a question embedded in your comments, and it's a very important question. For all my comments about empathy, there's been an awful lot of violence in the world. And the question is, how did we come from this wonderful bonobo that is love, not war, to being, a lot of violence and war. That's a complicated question, and I think and I hope to address that at a later date if you'll have me back, but I'm still working on reading some rather difficult material to figure out where might that begin. But I think one of the beginnings, most of our existence has been in small, very small tribal groups. And while chimpanzees, as well as other primates, when they're in these small groups, they do raid nearby tribes of same species. They don't organize in a warlike fashion, but my guess is that once there was an explosion of population, remember I mentioned this exponential increase in population, with that came surplus of foodstuffs, and people lived in communities that no longer knew everybody, so it became more complex, more differentiated, and there are other things in our brains other than all this, wow, things are great kind of things, you know. So they start to develop a much more complex, differentiated culture. And I think part of that process, people started to sequester the resources and so things get really complicated after we grow up. And so I don't have a real answer to that, not that I know anybody does, but I'm reading some books that suggest some possibilities. Well, the brain's a complicated place. Roughly, and this is really rough, we have essentially three brains in one at the very least. We have a reptilian brain that takes care of our primary functions of breathing and doing ordinary things. And we have a mammalian brain, a primate brain, that is this sort of limbic system that deals with a lot of the emotional stuff. And that includes a lot more than just empathy. It includes fear and anger and all of the things that we do as emotional beings. And then we have the neocortex. We have the thinking brain and the perceptual kind of things that go on. But these three pieces are interlocked. And when you talk about a brain map, I mean, it's really complicated. I'm sure there are differences between conservatives and liberals, having listened a lot, unfortunately, to Rush Limbaugh. Can't believe we have the same brain, but but being more specific than that, and I don't really can't answer, but I think that it bears a lot of thinking about. And in a funny way, I've been studying a lot of Buddhist tradition, in addition to other. Be wonderful being retired. God, I'm You know, we are really complicated beings, and I think that we need to be very introspective about our own suffering and the suffering of others. And it's tricky, but so that's why keeping the dialogue is really important. You know, we're sort of all above we're all underwater. We're over our heads, but we're struggling to deal with it. Well, that's a good question. Well, I only know it by reading, but what the archaeologists have done is they dig, you know, and they find places where there are Neanderthals or whatever. They date the site by various technical means, and they look at the burial goods to see if there are any burial goods there. They look to see if there was some decoration put on the body, any jewelry. So that's how they may. There's a famous case which turns out not to be correct, which I was all excited about for a while, and then I have a way of sort of poking around to see if it. For a long time, there was a burial site of Neanderthals in deep in the Russian steppes, that where the child, there was a child, apparently it was a child that had died, and the child had flowers buried with it. So for a long time, people, anthropologists said that this was a burial site in the first, this was, I don't know, 100,000, a long time ago, not 100,000, whatever. But it turns out that rodents or other beasts had carried those flowers in there, but it took a very meticulous examination of the site to figure that out. So actually, the answer to your question, it is difficult, and there are only a handful of those sites. So One has to be a little careful about that kind of evidence. I recently discovered that I have this book on my shelf, one of my books on my shelf, called Lucy and Language. To my horror, you know, Lucy, she wasn't a she. They don't know whether it was a woman or a man. They have no idea. And I believed for a long time that this was a woman's skeleton. They have no clue, actually. And I was sort of astonished about that. So I'm learning all the time, and these things we have to be reasonable. But I've also seen the situation you just described with birds outside of our house in Door County. I came out one day, and there was this bird lying there, and I had just seen a bird flying away from it, and the bird kept coming back to that dead bird. And there's a lot going on in what we think of as simple organisms. But there are many examples of extending the boundaries, and I think we actually know a lot about doing that. And and Carolyn would be the person to ask a lot of those questions when she comes and gives her talk. But I think the Institute, the Center for Healthy Minds that Richie Davidson works in, I mean, they understand, and Carolyn works in that group as well. They understand a lot now about how to expand that circle. And each of us can do that. There are simple things we can do. There are complicated things we can do. But there's a way of actually doing that. People are doing it. And we do it. We care for strangers. I mean, I see that all the time. It does happen quite a bit. So I agree with you, but I think it's not as narrow as it's narrower in some people and others. I think there are temperamental issues. It gets complicated. So I'll leave it to Carolyn to give you a fully fleshed out answer. But I won't tell her, so she'll be surprised.
We'll now have closing words read by Morris, and it's especially beautiful ones from Rumi.
This is a poem called Say I Am You, Rumi, who lived from 1207 to 73. I am dust particles in sunlight. I am the round sun. To the bits of dust I say, stay. To the sun, keep moving. I am morning mist and the breathing of evening. I am wind in the top of a grove and surf on the cliff. Mast, rudder, helmsman, and keel. I am also the coral reef they founder on. I am a tree with a trained parrot in its branches. Silence, thought, and voice. The musical air coming through a flute, a spark of a stone, a flickering in metal. Both candle and the moth crazy around it, rose and the nightingale lost in the fragrance. I am all orders of being, circling galaxy, evolutionary intelligence, the lift and the falling away, what is and what isn't. You who know me, you the one and all, say who I am. Say, I am you.
So now, greet your neighbor, come have coffee and cake with us.